Florida officials are investigating certain groups for possibly breaking the vaccine passport ban. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Some of those groups that could get in trouble include the Miami Marlins and the Kravis Center in West Palm Beach. Legally, can there be vaccine passports? Can the state ban them? We're going to look deeper into the debate. Also,
I think a lot of people with disabilities, we have to advocate for ourselves to get that access in the first place.
Haley Moss wants to help people who are neurodiverse to overcome their challenges. She's Florida's first openly autistic lawyer. We're going to hear her inspirational story. And finally, it's fall, and that means a lot for sports fans to enjoy. But do South Florida sports fans really have anything to enjoy? All of that today on Sundial after the news. The program is made possible in part by support from Miami Cancer Institute. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thank you so much for joining us. Florida is investigating a list of businesses and local governments for potentially violating the state's vaccine passport ban. Among those on the list, the Miami Marlins, the Kravis Center in West Palm Beach, Starbucks, and many more. Now, this week, the state fined Leon County $3.5 million for violating the law. Leon County's government required COVID-19 vaccine proof from employees, and they fired 14 people for their refusal or failure to comply. Joining us now to discuss the legitimacy of this law and the enforcement of it is Dr. Leslie Beitsch. He's a courtesy professor at Florida State University's College of Medicine. Leslie, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
You know what? You're coming at this from this very unique perspective. You specialize in public health. You're a physician and a lawyer. So let's start with the law part. It prohibits companies from requiring proof of vaccination, but does not prohibit companies from requiring a vaccine. They just can't ask for the proof. And the state cites privacy rights. It seems these two principles can, you know, compete with each other, or am I reading into that wrong?
No, I think you're right on target. And of course, there are privacy rights related to personal health information that are, you know, in conflict potentially with an employer's right to make their workplace safe. And so these are, you know, competing rights. And not only do we have state laws here, we do have state laws, we have executive orders from the governor, and we have federal executive orders around vaccines. So a lot of law potentially out there.
So wanted to mention, I mean, like, when you look at it, the state health department argued that a vaccine mandate would be discriminatory. Could a vaccine mandate fall into that category of discrimination?
I think that's a spurious argument. It's if you rolled out a vaccine mandate in a incomplete or discriminatory manner, yes, I think that is certainly the case. That would be completely the opposite of the intent and purpose for having such a vaccination program. And the Department of Health, where I used to work for many years, is quite skilled at targeting populations who are more vulnerable, populations that are historically underserved and at higher risk. So that they are highly skilled at rolling out and implementing a vaccination program that is accessible to everyone.
Yeah, because I was thinking about people who have trouble accessing the vaccine, maybe transportation, time off work. I mean, can we just, would it be discrimination against them?
You know, the idea is actually to protect that group of people by getting us all in a place where we establish some form of herd immunity. And what we're discriminating against here is the potential to rid ourselves of the danger of the coronavirus. And so the very people that you just mentioned who are, again, potentially vulnerable and less able to access the vaccine are the ones you would be protecting by having the rest of the population, including them, if possible, and immunocompromised individuals, having them all vaccinated.
Is there any example of where it wouldn't be, where it would be non-discriminatory?
where having a vaccine program would be non-discriminatory. Yeah. We do that constantly. You know, for decades, we've had a vaccination program required for school entry. And, you know, that's in all comers, everyone entering preschool, for example, or, you know, or K through 12 has to meet certain vaccination requirements. And school districts and states all around the country have had that in effect for decades. And we constantly add new vaccines as the science around vaccine protection emerges.
The consideration of other marginalized communities who don't have access to, let's say, documentation, say immigrants, people experiencing homelessness, how do we take that into account with mandates?
I think that, you know, just like we've, you know, and to pick another controversy would be voter registration and voter access, right? That's the same group that we're trying to assure has access to identifications and able to vote. In this case, it's operating a little bit differently. So, you know, for a while, Florida was accused of being a vaccine tourist destination, if you recall, early on when the vaccine was more widely made available. So people were accessing the vaccine. But in this case, again, the concept here is to immunize as many people as we possibly can so that we reach a population level of vaccination that confers herd immunity for the entire population. So that if certain groups aren't able to access the vaccine, they may still be protected by the fact that everyone else has been vaccinated
and, of course,
and can't spread the virus.
You know, something else that comes up, you've heard it plenty of times in this conversation, is the First Amendment right, the freedom, you know, to not get vaccinated. Where does that fit in all this?
Yeah, I think individuals do have a freedom not to be vaccinated, and employers have freedom not to employ them. But there are few what I would call even, you know, First Amendment rights or any other constitutional right that's absolute. That your freedom not to be vaccinated may, in fact, conflict with my freedom to assemble, also a First Amendment right, safely, so that I might wish to go to a religious event or a protest or go to a concert, for that matter. I have the same right to do that in safety. And so when these rights conflict with one another, you know, you've got to do a, you know, kind of a legal analysis or a balancing of those rights.
And it's interesting, you talk about businesses and you know, what rights the state has over those businesses or what those businesses have, because I'm wondering, like with property rights, can a government tell a business what to require or not require?
You know, it can and frequently does, but it also has to take into account, you know, the cost of that. And, you know, there are constitutional rights to be compensated for taking of certain property rights. And, you know, if your land is taken for a road or something else. So this, yeah, this could cost businesses an incredible amount of money. Think about the cruise line and the conflict we're having here between federal law and state law. Again, tourism is Florida's second largest business. And the idea that we would not allow cruise lines, a big major component of our tourism industry that base themselves in Florida, many of them, you know, seems to be not in the best interest of our overall economy, which is important for all Floridians.
Yeah, and that was the situation where you have the state saying no vaccine passports, but the CDC putting very tight rules on the cruise industry, and the cruise industry deciding to go its own route in what it decided would be best for its profits. Again, talking with Dr. Leslie Beitch, a courtesy professor at Florida State University's College of Medicine, we're talking about the legal ramifications of the vaccine passport ban and what rights governments and businesses and individuals have in this debate about vaccine requirements, but especially the vaccine passport. Follow us on Facebook or Twitter at WLRN Sundial, because that's always a place where you can post your questions if you have one about this conversation. I want to take a closer look at the story of Leon County. Again, they have been fined $3.5 million for violating the vaccine passport law. The county's government required the vaccine proof from its employees. They fired 14 people who refused or failed to comply. The county contends it's complying with the law. So do they have a case?
Well, they're also following the guidance at the federal level that employers with 100 or more employees have a workforce that's vaccinated or have mechanisms in place for them to be regularly tested. And so they're in the spirit of that, you know, federal executive order issued by the Biden administration. You know, that it's going to be an interesting question about whether they can they're able to do that with the Florida anti-passport law. There's longstanding, you know, public health litigation on these issues dating back to literally a 1905 case that before the U.S. Supreme Court. It's one of the most famous public health cases called Jacobson versus Massachusetts. And this case revolved around a county's requirement that individuals receive a smallpox vaccination, a pretty severe, scary disease that was prevalent in that period of our history.
Yeah, and so, I mean, that's no, the Jacobson, Massachusetts, v. Massachusetts case in 1905. How is that going to play out today, though?
I think the way it plays out is it says that you can make rules and laws that require vaccination in the interest of the greater public good, and that some individual rights may be tabled or withheld during that period of time in order to protect the safety of the collective. And I think there's easily an interpretation of Jacobson versus Massachusetts that would favor those institutions, whether we're talking about schools and school boards, employers, or county government, that they're operating with the spirit and intent of Jacobson versus Massachusetts, even if they may run afoul potentially of the state anti-passport law or executive orders issued by the governor.
So I want to come back to what you said earlier and just, you know, when you have the conflict between state and federal law, usually how does the court handle that?
Great question, and I'm glad you came back to that. There's an issue known as a legal doctrine known as preemption, and that, you know, federal trumps state, trumps local. And it's that state that's trumping local that's caused so much heartburn in Florida, the abolition or the sacrifice of home rule. In this case, when the federal government intervenes with a legal principle or a legal edict or a law of some sort, that it supersedes the state law. And, you know, it requires them to be pretty closely aligned for that preemption to take place here. And it looks to me like we're headed for a showdown, a legal showdown regarding whether there is, in fact, preemption allowing the federal laws to trump, with quotes around that word, the state and local activities in this area.
So, I mean, thinking, if that's the case, then, you know, the Florida's ban, you know, on vaccine passports isn't going to hold up.
That would be the interpretation of many public health, you know, experts in this field, that it sets a dangerous precedent. It sets a dangerous precedent, and state law will be held in abeyance.
And you know what? Somebody wants to get a hold of you really badly right now. But you know what? I was curious. You became a physician first, and then a lawyer. So what brought on the exploration for a second career in law?
You know, really the two for me have always been, you know, inextricably linked. And but the reason that I did go to law school is I attended medical school courtesy of the United States Air Force. They paid my way through. And it was my first real exposure to clinical practice. And I learned that many of the diseases that I saw regularly in my Air Force practice were diseases that were preventable, diseases that could be mitigated by health promotion, disease protection kinds of things. And I hadn't been trained in that up to that point. And I realized that public health and preventive medicine really were the things that could limit or improve our life expectancy, our overall health. And I also realize that many of the decisions that we make concerning health are policy decisions, and policy is uniquely in the realm of law and politics. And I thought, armed with a greater understanding of the law, that I could influence policy that might help us make more healthy choices as a society.
You know, I'm just wondering, Leslie, if, you know, the world has seen this before, right? We went through the Spanish flu, you know, a century ago, and I'm wondering if we've been through this battle in the courts before, that we could look back and say, yeah, see, this is how it's handled. Or was it totally different?
Well, I think we had some of the same issues, and, you know, in terms of, you know, how people responded, and before the vaccine, we had some of the same tools, and some of the same tools would have been masking and social distancing, and clearly there weren't good tests done there. So testing and contact tracing was available. Quarantine and isolation were also available. But one of the things that's so different, and in my view, concerning, is, you know, people respected science then. And of course, the science that we knew in 1918 about flu, you know, a virus that previously heretofore had not been a human pathogen. We didn't know a lot about viruses. And the science emerged, and the responses of how we dealt with the pandemics were very dynamic based on what we learned about the emerging science. We're in another situation where we're confronting a virus that is a novel coronavirus that previously has been undiscovered, not known to be a human pathogen, and the science is rapidly emerging here. And, you know, it's made for some really interesting dynamism in our whole process. So we know that masking and social distancing work, contact tracing and, you know, testing and contact tracing work, but we didn't have any other tools. Now we have vaccines, we have immunoglobulins that we can actually use. So, you know, we ought to change our policy and approach as we know more and as the science unfolds. And I think that's what CDC is trying to do in terms of guidelines. We know vaccine mandates are effective in getting more people to be vaccinated, even if they might have personal hesitation about doing that. That's where the science is today. And it may turn out that we learn things to suggest that masking isn't as effective as we think it is. Well, we have to wait for that science to be known, or it doesn't matter as much in schools. We don't know that yet. And while we're waiting for that science to emerge, it's relatively a modest burden to ask people to do some of those things to protect others, particularly vulnerable members of our society, so that we might have some individual burdens in order to have collective better health.
Well, as you said, I think that with we coming back to this idea of this battle, you know, over vaccine mandates and the vaccine passport laws and you know, these are all now in court. Really interesting to watch how this is all going to play out. But as you said, there's some history already there, so we know. Dr. Leslie Beitch, again, courtesy professor at Florida State University's College of Medicine. Leslie, thank you so much. I really appreciate the insight.
Well, and thank you for having me. Take care.
Definitely. You know, one other thing, too, just to point out, I was thinking about history is, you know, history of vaccines goes back a bit. Go back to George Washington. George Washington, the first president of the United States, actually required his troops to get inoculated for smallpox. Did it play a difference, make a difference in the war? Yeah, that's for another conversation. Well, still to come, we introduce you to Haley Moss and her incredible life story of becoming Florida's first openly autistic lawyer. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Defying odds and debunking misconceptions has been a major mission for many neurodiverse advocates. One of those is Haley Moss. In 2019, she became the first openly autistic lawyer in Florida. This month, the American Bar Association is presenting her with the Making a Difference by Breaking Barriers Award. Her new book, The Young Autistic Adult's Independence Handbook, comes out in November. Now, we spoke with Haley earlier this week about how she had to advocate for her needs in college and law school. And she also told us how Harry Potter helped her understand her autism diagnosis. Did you always want to be a lawyer?
To be honest, not really. I thought when I was going to college and all that good stuff, I thought that I wanted to be a doctor. And I thought that for me, that meant being a psychiatrist, because as someone with autism who thinks that it's really hard to understand people, I think that the coolest thing could be, or at least I thought this at the time, and I still think it's pretty cool actually, was to understand how the human brain works. So my plan was to major in psychology and eventually become a psychiatrist down the line. Enter first year chemistry, which made me realize that I wasn't exactly passionate about science. And I was kind of back to the drawing board. I still stuck with being a psychology major because I did want to understand humans, because I already miss enough social cues and sometimes don't always understand what people do. And I thought the logical way to understand that was to learn how the brain works. And I ended up realizing, what do I actually enjoy? And I realized I love to write. I love to talk. And whatever I do has to be able to make a difference for other people. And that's how I ended up kind of coming around to this idea to go to law school, is realizing that lawyers have the potential to do all of those things.
When you started to study law, did people know about you? And did that ever play a role? Like, did people doubt you? Or were you quiet about it?
I don't think I was necessarily quiet. So I've always been fairly open about my autism. I started getting involved in advocacy and writing and all that when I was a teenager. So I inadvertently became open at that point in my life. I didn't realize the impact it would have on the rest of my life. But for me, being open was something that I realized was vulnerable. It was a choice, and it was also a privilege. I think that folks have absolutely doubted me every step of the way on my journey. I think people have wondered, even when I went to college, I went to the University of Florida. Is that so big? That's so far away. You won't be able to handle it. And I'm like, I'm determined. I want to be able to do this. And even when it was incredibly hard, I still felt like I can do this. And I felt the same way about law school. And I think what's really hard isn't necessarily that disability is the thing that gets in the way of making it impossible. It's the fact that the systems that kind of surround education and also the workplace make it really difficult. So sometimes you might get denied accommodations. You might not have access to support that you need. There's all sorts of different reasons that folks with disabilities might not be able to succeed in these environments that have nothing to do with the disability itself. So I think when we're thinking about doubting folks, we really do put that pressure on the disability and also the person themselves to kind of overcome things, when a lot of it really is attitudes and other barriers that other people put in the way.
And when you were going through college and then law school, talking about the accessibility, was it there, or did you have to push a little bit?
I don't want to speak for anyone but myself, but I think a lot of people with disabilities, we have to advocate for ourselves to get that access in the first place. So I think I was very lucky in undergrad that I did have access, especially because I wanted help with housing, because I was very scared to live alone. Not necessarily alone. I was more afraid to live away from home. And I was afraid to have a nightmare roommate, as many young people are. But once I got to law school, I realized I was kind of forging my own path. I was kind of self-accommodating more than I would like to admit. So I was kind of readjusting how I was studying, how I was balancing being an adult and doing regular life stuff, like making sure I can keep up with laundry and cooking and keeping my house clean, all that stuff at the same time as the demands of law school and all the reading and all the studying and all of that. So that was really difficult. And I think for me, there's no way that a university setting would have been able to help me with some of the things that I struggled with most in my daily life. But I think that there are things looking back that might have been more helpful had I had known to advocate for them.
You know, listening to you, I'm getting a picture of what I think motivates you, but I'm wondering, what is it that motivates you? What keeps you going?
I just want to make a difference for other people, to be quite honest. I think that's what keeps me going in my professional life. And I think what I've learned the older that I get, so I'm in my late 20s now, is that I want to do things for myself. Is when you're a young person, and especially a young person with a disability, you often hear in your life people saying what you can't do, or somebody else is setting limits on your behalf, saying that you can't do this because you can't do something else. It even started when I was first diagnosed. I was 3 years old, and the first things that my family were told were about how I'd be lucky if I made a friend, if I finished high school, if I held a driver's license. They were told all of these things that maybe I would or would not be able to do. And of course, when you're a young person and you know that folks have low expectations, your whole goal is kind of to just prove them wrong. You think that that's the best way to go, is prove people wrong. And the older I get, the more I realize that that's not who I am and what I'm about. I don't want to just prove people wrong and say, look, I'm not a statistic. I want to do things for myself. It's not about proving people wrong or proving people right. It's about challenging myself and doing honestly what I realize is going to make me happy. And that thing that really makes me happy is being able to make a difference for other human beings. Of course, I want the same things as everybody else does. I want to be happy. I want to be successful. I want to have friends and love and all the same things in life that most of us do.
We spoke to Haley Moss earlier this week. She's the first openly autistic lawyer in Florida. Her advocacy work for people with neurodiverse conditions is being recognized by the American Bar Association. She's going to receive the Making a Difference by Breaking Barriers Award this month. You can find more information about this story on our social media at WLRN Sundial. My understanding is your parents had a sit down with you when you were 9 to tell you about your autism, right?
They did. And when I was 9 years old, I was absolutely obsessed with Harry Potter. And I know when I was 9, so that was the early 2000s or so. And that's when all the movies were just coming out. I believe the first or second movie just came out at the time. Might have to double check the dates and getting my math right. But that puts us at around about 2003. So, and what happened at that point when I was obsessed with Harry Potter is one day during the summer, my parents tell me that I have magical powers just like Harry Potter. And being 9 years old, of course, I'm going to buy this. I'm going to 100% believe it. And what happens is they explain to me what autism is and how autism is neither better nor worse. It's just different. And different can be extraordinary. So this wasn't the big bad wolf in my life. This wasn't going to be some horrible thing that I had to deal with. It was this thing that was just different. And that's not necessarily a bad thing. Just like in the Harry Potter books, Harry is obviously different than his peers. He doesn't fit in with the muggles, and he also doesn't fit in with the wizards. But either way, he's still the hero of the story. And I thought that was a really impactful and powerful point to make. And honestly, it gave me a lot of confidence and self-esteem as I was growing up.
That is a fun story. I'm a big Harry Potter fan, too. So, I totally hear you on that. By the way, House of Hufflepuff. There you go. How about that?
That's a good choice.
That's the one I got put in. Since I got you here, I wanted to ask you, in the news these days, we are seeing a lot about this word conservatorship or guardianship. And of course, it's a story with Britney Spears. But that story has brought these terms to the forefront. For those who are not familiar, how does that arrangement work? I was so confused about it.
So here in Florida, we're a guardianship state. So conservatorship is largely what California calls it. And guardianship is a legal proceeding in which another person essentially is in charge of the affairs and things of another person, usually someone with a disability that the court considers incapacitated for some reason. And usually the people who end up under guardianship are people with intellectual and developmental disabilities like myself, or people who are over the age of 65 who might have some other condition like an Alzheimer's or dementia who may not be able to care for themselves. And essentially what happens under guardianship is someone who is a guardian, usually it's a family member or it's a professional guardian, is in charge of this person's affairs and makes a lot of major life decisions on their behalf. So you can have limited guardianship and lose some rights, or you can have a full guardianship and lose most of your civil rights. So you might not be able to vote. You might not be able to make healthcare decisions. You might not have healthcare provided to you. There's all sorts of things that go on in the system. And honestly, the thing that makes it really difficult, and as I think a lot of people are noticing for the first time with Britney Spears, is that it's very difficult to get out of a guardianship or a conservatorship. It's not like, oh, we changed our mind, let's just start over. It doesn't always work like that.
So I'm wondering, what are you thinking about as you see this story unfold, bringing these topics to the forefront?
It makes me hopeful for reform. It makes me really hopeful when I see that people are realizing that the system exists. It's not always fair. A lot of it is usually kept behind closed doors. It's usually pretty confidential. Usually, again, it's kind of family matter stuff. But seeing people have this interest in it and realizing that there's something that doesn't seem fair makes me hopeful that we might see some reform, or we might see some less restrictive alternatives like supported decision making really take hold. And that's something I'm involved with here in Florida as well, is really trying to get that push for supported decision making to be part of our guardianship reform here. So basically that people can make decisions with the help of people that they trust, which I think is super cool. We all kind of do that in our regular lives anyway. And I think with guardianship, the other thing that makes it so alarming to me, and I've been involved with this before Brittany's case really got the publicity that we're seeing now, is that I realize this with a lot of disability rights, is that honestly, it could have just been one different decision in my life that could have gotten me into a very similar situation. So it could be that parents just aren't educated on options. They're told from school districts that this is what you have to do, or educators or financial advisors, and they just don't realize what else is out there. Or they realize it might be the only way they can have some semblance of control in an adult child with a disability's life. So it's really interesting to see. And I'm really hopeful, honestly, that we do have that reform. I'm hopeful to see that folks have more rights, or at least have more options to challenge a conservatorship or guardianship when they are used. It's something that should be used as a last resort and often is not the case.
And you're working with lawmakers on those alternatives, right?
The folks behind this, I don't want to take credit for everything that they do, but it's really through Disability Rights Florida. They have a coalition that's I Decide Florida to help pass things like supported decision making. And it's really powerful to see the folks who are behind that. So you have all sorts of different disability advocates, disability nonprofits and advocacy groups. You have people who've successfully gotten out of guardianships that are really leading the charge. So I don't want to take credit for all the work they're doing, but I am honored to be among their ranks.
The work that you're doing in trying to, you know, working with lawmakers, working with disability rights groups, I'm wondering, you know, a big takeaway for you, and what experience did you gain, or what did it do for you in your life? How did it change you?
I think for me, it's realizing how much power we hold. And I think for me, it's really examining how much privilege and luck I've had in my own life and wanting to give back. So the way that I feel about a lot of my work, especially in the neurodiversity space, in the autism space, in the disability space, is realizing what can I do to make things better for the next generation so that they don't face the same obstacles that I've had to face and the ones that are mostly unnecessary. That's kind of my frame of view, is how can I make things better? I think a lot of us have this idea of we want to leave the world better than we found it. And it doesn't mean that it has to be the biggest change in the world. It could just be something small, but it's enough to make a difference in another person's life.
Are you working on a book right now on this?
I actually do have a book coming out in November called The Young Autistic Adult's Independence Handbook. So it's basically for young people on the autism spectrum who are transitioning to adulthood, getting out of that high school age, maybe getting out of college. And you realize that a lot of life skills and a lot of being able to advocate for yourself, all of these things that we're talking about are things that most people take for granted. And there are skills that actually have to be taught. So I wanted to write something that I realized could be helpful, something that might have been extremely helpful to 18-year-old me. And also the way that I wanted to do it was I wanted to talk to people who also had more experience than I did in things that I didn't necessarily have experience in. So I was able to talk to different psychologists. I was able to talk to different autistic people. I was really trying to get that wealth of experience and knowledge to help make it better for the next person. And whether it's something like, how do I do laundry? How do I keep my house clean? How do I vote? All sorts of random stuff that it would be really great if someone just spelled out for you. So maybe it's a little less daunting.
And that's a lot of what you're doing now is advocacy work and education. I'm wondering, was there a point where you decided, you know what, instead of practicing law, I want to go do this instead. I want to educate.
I think whether or not I knew it, I was always an educator. So I got involved with writing books and the autism advocacy scene when I was a young teenager. I went to my very first conference when I was 13. I thought that I was going because I wanted to go to Disney World because it was in Orlando. And it turned out that what I said really resonated with people. And that's when I was offered the opportunity to write my first book, and I absolutely jumped at it. And I realized for me that was something I was super passionate about and super excited. So I've always been involved in this. But when I started law practice, it somehow took off at the same time because I was billed as Florida's first openly autistic attorney. And that was super, super exciting and really cool. But also, I realized there was such a need to keep going. And there was so much that people needed to learn, whether it was about disability discrimination, whether it was about neurodiversity, no matter what it was. And I wanted to help do my part. So I realized that I had a chance to be able to keep educating people, and I didn't want to pass up on that. And I realized that maybe this is the difference that I've been wanting to make and that I'm supposed to be making.
And as you said, because it was 2019 when you became the first openly autistic lawyer in Florida. Since then, have you met others in the profession who are neurodiverse?
Absolutely. And I think that's one of the greatest joys that I have as well, is I get to mentor young and older neurodivergent law students and attorneys who are either beginning to share for the first time they're neurodivergent, they might have just learned that recently, or they're trying to figure out how to disclose. So our profession has always had neurodiversity within it. I think it's just folks haven't been open for a variety of different reasons. So maybe it's the stigma, maybe it's access to a diagnosis, maybe it's just that they don't feel comfortable in their own skin. There's so many reasons why someone may or may not share that they're neurodivergent. And I really do take that as a responsibility, and also recognizing that it's a privilege that I feel like I'm able to be my full self no matter where I go.
You are receiving an award, my understanding is, from the American Bar Association, the Making a Difference by Breaking Barriers. First of all, congratulations. What does that mean for you?
I am honestly completely humbled and blown away. I didn't know what I was setting out to do when I first went to law school. I feel like sometimes is I was thinking, I just know I want to make a difference for other people with disabilities. And I never realized that the impact that I would have, especially this early on in my career, would be so vast. So I'm truly blessed. And I really just hope to keep it going. And I hope that this is something that the next generation as well of disabled attorneys are able to realize, that you too have so much power. And it's up to us to really be the change, be present, and we really have this within us. So this isn't just about me. I don't want this to be just about me. I think it's a huge honor on behalf of the entire disabled and neurodivergent community. And I'm really, truly blessed to be able to represent us.
You know, you talked about how in the book, you know, you were kind of almost giving your 18-year-old self some advice. But what is that advice that you have for people who are on the autism spectrum or another neurodiverse condition? What do you want to tell them?
Please be yourself. That the world is not always fair. It's not always designed with you in mind. And sometimes it's frustrating that you have to advocate for yourself even when you don't feel comfortable, but you have so much power within you and you are perfect just the way you are. That you don't have to change who you are in order to fit into neurotypical society, that you can absolutely be yourself. And whatever you're good at, whatever you enjoy, please keep up whatever you're doing, because so much of the things that we enjoy, we might be told that it's not going to translate into a career, that maybe it's not age appropriate, whatever that's supposed to mean, or so many other things, that stay with what you like, because so often we focus on what's hard for us and not so much our joy. So try to have as much joy in your life as possible.
And, you know, I think about it, I can't get it out of my head. It's like, you know, what your parents said to you and how they helped you. And I'm wondering, what is that advice that you have for parents? How do you help them?
When I think about parents, I think about focus on your child's strengths. Again, they're not broken. They're just different. And that's not a bad thing, just like my parents taught me. And chances are kids know if they're different. So maybe they're bullied in school. Maybe they just feel different. They might not be socializing with others in the same typical ways, but they're amazing human beings and you love them and show them that love. And again, focus on those strengths and encourage that joy. I think so much of seeing autistic joy and neurodivergent happiness and passion is so valuable. And it's something I want to see more of in this world. So keep encouraging the young people in your life to be who they are and to enjoy the things that they love, and you'll be surprised.
That was Haley Moss, Florida's first openly autistic lawyer. She has a new book coming out in November. It's called The Young Autistic Adults Independence Handbook. Amazing, amazing story. Thank you so much, Haley, for sharing it with us. Well, still to come, South Florida sports fans may have something to be hopeful for this fall. Maybe. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. You know, fall is a wonderful time to be a sports fan. Come on, let's face it. We have football and basketball and hockey. But being a South Florida sports fan, well, that could be tough. We don't have as many winning teams as, say, our neighbors further north, like Tampa. They've actually started calling themselves Champa because they won a Super Bowl and a couple Stanley Cups. Well, we may not have much to cheer for in football, but the Florida Panthers and the Miami Heat are about to start their new seasons, and maybe, just maybe, there's a chance that they could be competitive teams. And we have something to cheer for. Joining me now, Miami Herald sports reporter David Wilson. David, welcome to the program.
Yeah, we're at least doing better than Jacksonville and Orlando, so we've got that going for us.
All right, we can say that. All right, please tell me.
Second best in Florida.
Definitely. David, please tell me, as a sports fan, that the Panthers and the Heat are about to start their seasons. Tell me that there's something I can look forward to, that they're going to be good this year.
Yeah, I'm really bullish on the Panthers. Obviously, last season was... It was a shortened year, but by most metrics, kind of their best regular season ever. End up losing in the first round of the playoffs because of a weird playoff format because of COVID and a unique division structure. Lose to the eventual champion, Lightning. But I think it's, you know, it was easy to come away from last year's playoffs and say the Panthers were probably one of the five or so best teams in the NHL. And seems like it should be the same way again this year. I mean, they're going in. It's not Stanley Cup or bust because I think they've got a nice little multi-year window they've carved out for themselves. But I think they definitely view themselves as a legit Stanley Cup contender. Heat, I'm also pretty high on, not quite as high as I am with the Panthers, if only because I think hockey tends to be much more wide open. You know, you see 7 and 8 seeds make the Stanley Cup finals pretty regularly in the NBA. It tends to usually be a 3 or 4 team race most years, basically who's got LeBron, who's got Giannis, who's got Kevin Durant. But I think the Heat are, you know, obviously I'm sure we'll get to this, but the Brooklyn Nets, who I think were a lot of people's favorites, are having some issues right now with Kyrie Irving and vaccination stuff. But before, you know, who knows how that's going to play out, but I think the Heat, it's easy to view them as maybe the third best team in the East behind the Nets and the Bucks, and obviously that puts you a break away from really being in the mix to do something even bigger than that.
Yeah, and by the way, you know, as you mentioned, look, the last couple of years have been weird. With the pandemic, we had shortened seasons, and everything had to be restructured in a strange way. So we're supposedly back to normal. But are the arenas back to normal? Are we allowing full arenas now again?
Yeah, everything's full. I mean, there's still some, like, mask requirements here and there, obviously, as anyone who's been anywhere where there are mask requirements. You know, I think everyone knows the enforcement can be a little spotty. But, you know, when you see these crowd shots, people have masks. Sometimes it's dangling over their chin or whatever. But, you know, that's... We're back to normal for the most part, as long as you don't mind wearing your mask, right? And I think for a lot of people, that's a trade-off they're willing to make, obviously, these days to get back in a full arena.
Right. And by the way, the other thing, too, is, I mean, I look at how there have been controversies in the NFL and the NBA, and you were talking about Kyrie Irving, that's a basketball player for the Nets, who refuses to get vaccinated, and now he can't even practice with a team. But how has the NHL handled the vaccine issue?
The NHL, I don't know the exact numbers off the top of my head, and I'm not sure if they've released the specific. I think the NBA I saw today was reported as up to 96%. So, you know, you hear about guys like Kyrie, but they're outliers. Everyone is doing well for the most part. NHL, as far as I know, I think is even higher than that. The Panthers and the Heat, as I should mention, are both fully vaccinated, their rosters. Yeah, the NHL has done, I think, a pretty good job with that. You know, a lot of, obviously, it's not that the vaccine hesitancy is a uniquely American problem, but it is, you know, kind of worth noting. The NHL, obviously, a smaller percentage of American players. I do wonder how much that plays into it. I don't want to guess what the attitudes are in different countries across the world, but the NHL has done a really good job of it. And at least down here in South Florida, with our winter teams, the Heat and the Panthers, it does not seem like it should be an issue. Obviously, there's breakthrough cases and stuff like that,
right.
But everyone is at 100%, so that's a good sign.
And, you know, again, as I mentioned, the Florida Panthers, they're starting their regular season tonight, actually, at home against the Pittsburgh Penguins. The Miami Heat's season opener is on the 21st, and that's going to be a home game. They're taking on the defending champion Milwaukee Bucks. Again, talking with David Wilson of the Miami Herald, talking about sports in South Florida. I know we don't have a lot of sports teams to root for, but maybe we do. Maybe the Heat and the Panthers will give us something. By the way, David, I don't know if I'm going to get used to this anytime soon. The FTX Arena, where the Heat play, I don't know. It doesn't roll off the tongue.
It's better than Lone Depot Park, I think. But but yeah, Maybe we'll get used to it. It's Loan Deep. My issue with Loan Depot Park is we style we go with their style, which means in the middle of the sentence I've got like a random lowercase L, a capital D, and then a lowercase P. It's a personal pet peeve. But yeah, FTX Arena is pretty weird. I have started trying to at least, because I think most people probably around town still call it American Airlines or the AAA or whatever. I started just saying it's the Heat Arena, trying to kind of ease my way to FTX.
It's gonna be at the tip of my tongue every
Yeah,
time.
Exactly.
I gotta ask you, what is going on with the hurricanes? I mean, you know, look, the frustrating part is we used to have a really good team. We dominated college football. Granted, that was a long time ago, but why can't we rebuild a team? Why can't we rebuild a winner?
Well, this could be a like an hour long segment
Oh, okay.
probably.
Well, give me two
But yeah,
minutes.
no, I mean the biggest, I mean there's a couple of big reasons. One is, and this isn't a reason why they're not necessarily, they should still, given the level of talent and the players they recruit down here, you know, a lot of South Florida, but also, you know, they're the U, they get guys from all across the country. They're not getting the Alabama, Clemson, Ohio State, Georgia caliber of players. Like they're getting their own tier. Like they're, I think anyone who pays even a little bit of attention to college football kind of knows that those are, in a lot of ways, the only teams that matter when we get to the end of the year, typically. You know, there's an outlier, LSU here and there, Notre Dame, Penn State, but Miami should be in that second tier. So that's the biggest reason that they are not a perennial national championship contender like they were 20 years ago now, is the recruiting. But I mean, it's been, seems like for the most part, a bunch of underwhelming coaching hires in a row. I think Mark Richt, who was the coach before Manny Diaz and kind of abruptly retired a couple years ago now, he didn't know at the time, but he's now dealing with Parkinson's, and he kind of has said that last year he kind of was dealing with a lot of fatigue, probably the early symptoms of that. He was, you know, came obviously with a good reputation from Georgia, did a lot of good things for the program, but otherwise,
So wait
you
a
know,
minute.
three of the last four coaches have been underwhelming, you know, 500 level
So is I
coaches.
mean is it the then the coach? Is it the recruiting? And because I mean I'm thinking to myself, you know, now that athletes can get paid, it doesn't really matter where they go because they can make money anywhere. This is
Yeah.
the kid from Alabama, the quarterback in Alabama is making almost $1 million now. But so is it we need a good coach, the right coach, or we need to do recruiting again? What are we doing? What do we need to do?
I think it's a, it, I mean, it's all kind of intertwined, right? And I think it starts with the coach. I mean, Manny Diaz, it's not, obviously not been a great year. Last year was pretty good, and I think he knows there are issues. He's trying to fix them. But again, he's a first-time head coach. I think, you know, he's, I don't think it's a secret to anyone that he's on the hot seat here. And if he doesn't turn things around, then he's probably not going to be the coach of Miami again next year. They've really got to, I mean, they got to nail a hire. It's kind of, that's the starting point. Manny Diaz has actually recruited pretty well, I think, especially given the record he has here, which again is right around 500 basically. But it's going to take a good coach to kind of build up that foundation. You know, they're a long way
A long
from
way.
being Alabama, Clemson, Ohio State, and that takes recruiting at, to get to that level, you have to recruit at like hyper elite level. Miami recruits at a good level right now.
Yeah, a
But
long way.
the first step is they got to, you know, when they came to the ACC and structured these two divisions, the Atlantic and the Coastal, they put Florida State in the Atlantic. They put Miami in the Coastal. They pictured those two playing in the ACC championship every year, and Miami's won the Coastal once. So they
And
got to, I
that's
mean, that's, you're competing against Virginia. You're competing against,
Yeah, that was
you know, like lesser teams. They're
is a long
supposed to
time
win that
ago.
division.
It was a long time ago and they were good. All right. In 20 seconds, tell me real quick, where do you think the Panthers finish? Where do you think the Heat finish?
I think Panthers, I would guess, I think Heat, I feel pretty confident, not confident obviously, but I feel pretty like good picking them to finish third in the East. The NBA is weird where, you know, teams care way more about the playoffs than they do about the
All right, so
regular season. Some guys take games off, but
the Heat
I take
finish
third.
high, and what about the Panthers?
Panthers, you know, second in the division
Oh,
basically, I think
okay.
is
Oh,
probably safe
okay.
to say.
All right. Okay,
You
that's
know, they
good.
got a good division, but they're both of those teams are, I don't want to necessarily say they're
All
like
right.
championship contenders, but they're right there. They're on
Look,
the fringes.
you gave me something to root for. That's all that matters. David Wilson, sports reporter with the Miami Herald. David, thanks so much.
Yeah, of course. Thanks for having me on.
And you can follow his reporting on our social media, WLRN Sundial. Come on, Panthers. Come on, Heat. Give me something to root for. Well, that's our program for this Thursday, October 14th. Coming up next week on the show, we're going to dive deep into the opioid crisis with a story about a family who lost multiple members to this epidemic. Incredible story next week on this. And by the way, don't forget, we're going to be talking with Carl Hyacin tomorrow. His book, Squeeze Me, that is the October Sundial Book Club pick. We're going to do a recorded interview with him. Go on our Facebook, Sundial Book Club. Post a question. If you've ever wanted to ask Carl Hyacin a question, post it there. I got a post there for you. And I'm going to ask those questions of Carl tomorrow. I'm Luis Hernandez. Have a great Friday, a wonderful weekend. Stay safe. Be good to each other. The program is made possible in part by support from Miami Cancer Institute.
WLRN Public Media.